So a pleasure to be here. And Chris is a good friend, so I'm really excited to be able to do an event with her. And I hope by the end of this, David's a good friend too. I think I might be the perfect person to moderate this panel because on the one hand, I have very strong views on the legal side of it. I think that I certainly agree with David. I think the law is pretty clear. And I think that Judge Sullivan should have granted DOJ's motion to dismiss, and I think ultimately that's likely to be what happens. On the other hand, personally, I really want this case to continue absolutely as long as possible, because I personally believe that the true villain in this case is not Michael Flynn, but is actually the FBI and the DOJ. And the longer this case stays in the public eye, the more people are going to realize that the true story of the Flynn case, at least the way I see it, is not what Flynn may or may not have done, but what was done to him in an effort to coerce him into pleading guilty to a crime that the Department of Justice now says he never committed. But we're going to work our way through the procedural posture of the case and focus on that part of it. There are a lot of facts about the case that are in dispute, and we're going to try to avoid that in large measure. It's not really very enlightening to just go back and forth about facts that are contested. But what is really interesting, and I think is going to provide us with plenty of fodder for discussion, is this almost unprecedented posture of the case where the Department of Justice has advised the court that it no longer wishes to proceed with the prosecution, but instead of simply granting that motion to dismiss, the district court judge is pushing back. And I'm going to take about 2 minutes to set the stage and explain how we got to this point, and then Carissa and David will each have an opportunity to kind of state their case, and we'll just have a moderated discussion going forward, and we'll do some Q&A from the audience towards the end. So the genesis of this case was an interview that was conducted by two FBI agents with Michael Flynn in January of 2017 when he was the newly installed National Security Advisor. That interview occurred in the context of a counterintelligence investigation that was codenamed Crossfire Hurricane. General Flynn had been designated Crossfire Razor within that investigation, and he was interviewed ostensibly, and we may get into that later, but ostensibly as part of this counterintelligence investigation to see whether he may have had any role in assisting Russian officials in meddling in the 2016 election. The criminal charges that were ultimately brought against Michael Flynn allege that he made false statements to the FBI agents during that interview regarding certain conversations that he had had with the Russian ambassador, Sergei Kislyak, and also that he had made misstatements on some paperwork that he filed in connection with the Foreign Agents Registration Act in connection with some work that his consulting company did for Turkey. So prosecuted by the special counsel's office run by Bob Mueller, and in up until the end of November of 2017, Michael Flynn adamantly asserted his innocence. He was defending the case very vigorously with lawyers from Covington Burling and maintained his innocence. Then suddenly something happened to cause him to change his mind and decide to plead guilty. It has been reported that the thing that happened was that the special counsel's office leaked to the media a possible intention on their part to prosecute Michael Flynn's son, who was also his business partner, in connection with those FARA filings. This caused, allegedly caused Michael Flynn, something caused General Flynn to drop his defense and agree to plead guilty to an information that was presented in court on December 1st. He pled guilty on that day, but there was no sentencing. And for those who don't know, in a prosecution, the conviction does not become a judgment of conviction until a sentence has been passed by the court. That has not happened yet. There was a delay in sentencing. I'm going to skip over some of that procedural part of the case because I don't think it's exactly germane. But what ended up happening is General Flynn replaced his counsel at Covington Burling with a new lawyer named Sidney Powell and promptly filed a motion to withdraw his guilty plea on a number of grounds, including an assertion that the special counsel's office had withheld exculpatory or potentially favorable material from him that they should have produced. And the question essentially was, can he withdraw that guilty plea? There was litigation over that. And then what happened in something of a surprise, the Department of Justice earlier this month filed a motion in the district court before Judge Emmett Sullivan under Rule 48, which is a rule of criminal procedure that requires the government to seek leave of court to dismiss an ongoing criminal prosecution. These are typically granted out of hand without any real back and forth. But this time it was different. General Judge Sullivan refused to immediately grant the motion to dismiss, and instead appointed a former district court judge named John Gleason from the Eastern District of New York, now in private practice at Devebo's in Plimpton, to come in and argue as an amicus, friend of the court, whether or to take the position that Judge Flynn did not have an obligation to grant DOJ's motion to dismiss the prosecution. The defense team, led by Sidney Powell, then filed a mandamus petition in the D.C. Circuit, which issued an order promptly instructing Judge Sullivan to file a brief in the D.C. Circuit explaining the basis for his refusal to grant the DOJ's motion to dismiss under Rule 48. And that brings us up to the present day. There will be a hearing in the D.C. Circuit soon. And the question, and Judge Sullivan has in fact filed his brief. The Department of Justice has filed its own brief. There are some other amicus briefs out there. And what it all boils down to is two questions legally. First, is it appropriate for the D.C. Circuit to grant or to act on this mandamus petition? And if so, how should it act? Should the D.C. Circuit order Judge Sullivan to grant DOJ's motion to dismiss under Rule 48 and bring the case to an end? Or is there some legal room for the D.C. Circuit to come to a different conclusion that allows the case to go on? Carissa Hessick will take the position that there is a legal basis for the D.C. Circuit to send the case back to the district court for further litigation. And David is going to take the position that, in fact, the law requires the D.C. Circuit, well, the law requires the district court to grant the motion to dismiss, and that the appropriate result in this case would be for the D.C. Circuit to grant the mandamus petition and instruct the district court to grant DOJ's motion to dismiss so that the case would come to an end. Is that a fair description of the respective positions?
Yes.
Excellent. I think we agreed that, David, you would go first. Is that right?
Yeah. So thank you, Clark, and thank you, Jefferson and Chris. I'm looking forward to today's discussion. And I'd like to also thank the Federalist Society for putting this together so quickly. It's a really interesting and fascinating legal question, I think, but one that I believe Judge Sullivan and the D.C. Circuit should handle pretty easily, which is Judge Sullivan should have dismissed and the D.C. Circuit should grant mandamus. And the reason is the judiciary is there to adjudicate disputes, to judge cases or controversies, and to protect defendants from overreaching prosecutors. In this case, neither of those concerns are implicated. There is no more dispute. The parties have reached an agreement. The case should be dismissed. And there's no defendant's rights to be protected. The case is going to be dismissed against Flynn. So no one's rights are being violated by the dismissal. There are no rights to protect by continuing the case. And therefore, Judge Sullivan should have immediately dismissed the case. In our adversary system, each party is there to present their own case. And judges are there to judge those disputes. Here, the adversaries have agreed that the case should be dismissed. So there is no reason for the case to continue. There's nothing left for Judge Sullivan to judge. And I'll keep the opening remarks brief, but I'd like to end just with a hypothetical. I never got to ask my law professor's hypothetical, so I'd like to give one to Professor Hessick, to Carissa. So let's assume that last night one of the violators of the curfew got arrested and brought to court today and was told, if you plead guilty right now, you can go free, or you'll have to stay in jail for a while until the case proceeds through the system. And the person says, I'm gonna plead guilty. And the judge says, okay, we'll have sentencing in an hour. And in between that, the district attorney runs in and says, you know what, I've decided I'm not going to prosecute curfew violators. I'm just not gonna do it, so I'm gonna drop the case. And I think most of us would agree the judge in that situation should just drop it. And I use this as the shoe on the other foot example. We wouldn't want the judge saying, well, are you doing this for politics? Why are you doing this, district attorney? We don't want judges looking behind those decisions. We have political decisions made by prosecutors all the time. Those aren't illegal. There's nothing wrong with them. As long as they don't affect individual rights, we're okay with that. It should be no matter whether it's a Republican or Democrat defendant, it shouldn't matter whether it's General Flynn or the protester on the street. If the district attorney or the U.S. attorney decides I'm not going to go forward, that should be the end of it as long as the defendant agrees.
Great. So first of all, thank you so much for including me in this, and thank you for the incredibly warm welcome. This is a very important case that raises some difficult issues, and I'm really delighted that that the Federalist Society put together this panel, not just because they invited me, but because I always enjoy talking with Clark, and I think that David's been a particularly calm and rational voice explaining why people ought to want Judge Sullivan to grant the government's Rule 48 motion. But I do want to say just, and we will get into, as the debate continues, David's specific arguments about essentially how there's no controversy that this case has been mooted, what that means in the criminal context. And I'll answer his hypothetical too, because it's a good one. Before I do that, I want to be very clear about what I see my role as in a debate like this and more generally. So, as Jefferson noted, David is an incredibly talented and well-respected criminal defense attorney. If I ever find myself in trouble in Florida, I will hire David immediately.
Okay.
But as a criminal defense attorney, David comes to questions like this with a particular set of experiences and a particular point of view, a point of view that courts ought to intervene only to protect the rights of defendants. And that's a great point of view for a criminal defense attorney to have. It's, as a matter of ethics, a point of view that he has to argue in individual cases, and I'm not surprised to learn that he holds it as a sincere personal belief as well. But I'm not a criminal defense attorney. That's not my experience, and that's not my point of view. My job is to study and to critique the criminal justice system as a system. Now, sometimes my critiques lead me to say that the system doesn't do enough to protect defendants, but it often doesn't as well. And in particular, my study and my research on this issue has led me to believe that an important problem with the current criminal justice system is that we accord too much power to prosecutors. Too much power as a matter of doctrine, but too much power also as a matter of custom and practice. And so I come to this particular debate with a set of prior commitments that includes a commitment that judges can't simply defer to prosecutors, that judges have an important active role to play in the criminal justice system, and we should want that generally, not just in the case involving Michael Flynn, but more generally, we should want judges asking questions of prosecutors about why they make certain decisions. So to pick up on David's hypothetical, which I think is an excellent hypothetical, it's an excellent hypothetical because it forces us to ask what principles we care about and not just how certain facts make us feel. And the set of facts that David told us about are a set of facts where I would expect a judge to probably grant a motion by a defense attorney who comes in and who publicly proclaims that his or her office is taking a particular policy stance in all cases across the board. That statement's being made publicly. That DA is going to be accountable to voters, and voters who don't like that decision can decide to throw that DA out the next time an election comes along. But I would feel very differently about David's hypothetical if the DA rushed into a single courtroom to say, we are going to dismiss this case, and the defendant who had just pleaded guilty was the daughter of the district attorney or the child of someone in the district attorney's office. And similar decisions weren't being made in other cases. So I agree with David. We need to think about these hypotheticals and think about how they affect our intuitions about whether something is just or unjust. And then we have to think about what the facts are here to see which of those principles seems to take precedence.
And so let me respond to that, Krista, just about the too much power to prosecutors point. I mean, I think on that general idea, I couldn't agree more, surprising, right? Prosecutors have way too much power, and the DC Circuit must be a little confused about their position, because there's generally, in my experience, two main rules in appellate procedure. Rule number one is always rule for prosecutors. Now, in this case, they must be a little confused because their ruling was going to help a defendant as well. And so they may be in doubt, which means they have to refer to rule number two. When in doubt, always check rule number one. So, I agree that prosecutors have too much power. And that's why we have three branches. We have the judiciary to check prosecutors, but to protect defendants, not to act as a separate prosecutorial branch in case prosecutors are being too lenient. In cases where prosecutors are being too lenient, we don't have judges come in and say, I'm going to prosecute that case. I'm going to go forward and make sure that this case is prosecuted. So that's I think where we go in separate places.
Yeah. So I just want to be really clear, and I'm sorry, I don't want to sound too much like an academic right here. I hear you making a descriptive point about what judges and prosecutors do, and then I also hear you making a normative point about what they should do. And I'll just respond briefly to the descriptive point, which is sometimes judges do precisely that. They won't defer to prosecutors in making decisions if they think that those decisions are too lenient. And I'll point you to plea bargaining, where we've seen judges reject a plea bargain, a charge bargain, between prosecutors, and that prosecutors and defendants have arrived at and said, no, I don't think that's an appropriate resolution of this case. Now, we can have a separate normative discussion about whether judges ought to do that, but they do it. And just to make then, I guess, sort of a doctrinal point about what we do when two parties have agreed that they no longer want to pursue a case. I'm not a Fed Courts professor. I'm married to a Fed Courts professor, which is, I guess I'm, that makes me Fed Courts professor in law or something like that. But I just think we need to be really careful here when we throw around phrases like cases and controversy that obviously invoke in some people thoughts that this might be an Article III violation. And in fact, I should say, we don't need to be careful, like the Department of Justice made this claim in their brief to the DC Circuit. They said that it was a violation of Judge Sullivan's Article III powers to not simply grant this motion. And I'll just say, I think that that argument needs to be made very carefully, because it can, if not made carefully, tend to conflate things like standing and mootness. Chief Justice Rehnquist, until his last day on the court, was fighting the good fight that mootness wasn't jurisdictional, and he lost. But at the same time, there have been so many carve-outs and so many exceptions to the idea that a moot case can't proceed, that I don't think that we can quickly and without an awful lot more analysis than what we saw from the Department of Justice say that when two parties reach a resolution, that deprives a court of jurisdiction, because we know that there are lots and lots of examples of the Supreme Court telling us that that's actually not the case.
Except in the case of prosecutions, and you had a lot there, and there's a lot to respond there. So just in the case of prosecutions, if the Department of Justice said, I'm not going to bring a case, for instance, we'd all agree there is no case or controversy there. Or if the president said, I'm going to pardon a case, we'd all agree that the case is over, there's no case or controversy there. Here, the prosecution has said, I do not want to proceed with the case anymore. So what has the court done in those cases? It is, the Supreme Court and other courts have said, that you can't appoint a special prosecutor. Judges don't have the power to say, I'm going to have a prosecutor prosecute this case. Both practically and legally, I mean, if the judge were, how could the judge even deny this motion, right? What would the judge do? Say, I'm going to force the Department of Justice to go forward here. I'm going to appoint a special prosecutor to to proceed. We know that the judge couldn't have a special prosecutor prosecute this case. So do we even want that? I don't think we want judges prosecuting cases. All the cases say, you know, the judges shouldn't act as the U.S. attorneys. You know, prosecutors have enough power as it is. I don't think we need to give them more with judges sort of as a backstop.
I'm going to exercise my moderator's privilege to moderate, if I may, really quickly. I wanted to ask you a question, Chris. That's relevant to this discussion. By the way, I think you have now said normative, doctrinal, and jurisdictional, and I just want you to know I'm one space away from winning law professor bingo on my card.
No. I'm sorry. Then I would have to say it's really more of a comment than a question. Center square.
So, I think we have a sense of David's take on sort of the rationale and the framework for Rule 48 and the requirement that the government receive leave of court in order to dismiss a prosecution. What I'm curious to see if you can articulate for us is, what would be your framework? How would you articulate, you know, we could use the protester hypothetical that David used or any other one that you want to, but what would be the framework that a court would apply to determine whether or not the government's rationale or the totality of the circumstances do or do not support the government's desire to dismiss the case? Do you have a legal framework that you could share that you think would be appropriate to help us work through some of these cases?
That's a great question. And I would say that I don't have a ready-made framework to give to people to say, here's a checklist of situations in which judges should take a more active role as compared to other places where they should play a more ministerial role. But I do think that if we look at the history of Rule 48 and why it was adopted initially, we can see that this case seems to fit relatively comfortably in the category of cases that the Supreme Court and the advisory committee that drafted the rules were concerned about. So the reason we have this rule is because there were a series of prosecutions where Washington got involved and told local prosecutors, local federal prosecutors, to drop cases. And there was particularly concern about politically connected defendants having this happen. And so that's why it was brought in. It said, look, we can't have that sort of political interference in cases. And just to sort of complete the circle here about why I think this case fits comfortably within it, I think it's difficult to talk about the prosecution of Michael Flynn without acknowledging that this was part of an investigation where the Department of Justice thought it was, Rod Rosenstein thought it was necessary to appoint a special counsel, because either the reality or the perception was that the ordinary hierarchy in the Department of Justice was not going to be able to handle this case and related cases credibly, because they touched on the campaign of President Trump. So the thought was they needed to appoint a special counsel, it ended up being Robert Mueller, to prosecute these cases in order to avoid precisely what we saw here, which was political appointees within the Department of Justice deciding to do something else that was much, much, you know, much better for a defendant who had worked in the White House for this president and worked on his campaign. So I don't have a good checklist for you, but situations where it appears as though prosecutorial decisions are being driven by political favor is a box on that list.
Let me, David, I know you have a lot to say, and I want to flip it to you. I don't think this is going to be a softball, but it might be a breaking ball that doesn't break. I think you're probably going to be able to take this at least into the lower deck, and you might get it all the way out of the park. There are some people, and I would say that I'm one of them, who think that it's possible that Flynn was targeted for prosecution for fundamentally political reasons. And if the decision to dismiss those charges ended up being for fundamentally political reasons, how does that net out? Let's go back to your protester example. What if it turns out that a particular protester was prosecuted for something that no one else is being prosecuted for, maybe because they're the daughter or the son of somebody's political opponent, And so the initiation of the prosecution was political. And then we get to the decision to move to dismiss, and maybe other people aren't getting the benefit of the same largesse, but then the decision to dismiss seems to have been political. What are judges supposed to do with all of that?
Well, that is a softball, obviously. So let me see if I can take that, Clark. So I don't think there's anything wrong with, well, let me say it a different way. The people who are supposed to decide whether something's wrong politically is the electorate and not the judiciary. So I agree with Carissa and with your question that if there's politics wrapped up in this, and it sure appears to be that way here, right? I mean, there sure does seem to be a lot of politics involved. That's for either Congress or the electorate to deal with, not for a judge. And in fact, judges are not equipped to deal with politics. And that's why Carissa, I think, is going to have trouble coming up with a checklist or ways to deal with it, because they're just not set up for it and it's going to backfire. And that's why judges should stay away from this, and prosecutors get into politics all the time. You look at, there's discussion about how are the charges going in Minnesota? Are those political or not? Judges need to stay away from that. And one thing that I would say in response to Carissa on this point is, I think there is a dispute about why Rule 48 is there. Carissa, I think, is citing to that Frampton Law Review article that discusses the reason behind Rule 48. I'll quote the Supreme Court from 1977, which said the principal object of Rule 48 is to protect the defendant against prosecutorial harassment. That's what the Supreme Court said about Rule 48, and there's a good reason for that. The reason we have that leave of court provision is not so judges can start looking behind prosecutorial decisions, prosecutorial statements. I'm not sure how they would do that. I don't think anybody's articulated a way that they could do that, and we run into all kinds of trouble. The reason we have it is so that if a prosecutor on a Friday before a trial on Monday said, I'm going to dismiss the case because I want to take a vacation. And the defendant said, no, I object. I'm ready for trial. I'm ready to go on Monday. The judge could say, okay, I'm going to go with the defendant here. It's not consented to. We're going to have that trial on Monday. It's not to say where both sides agree. Let me see if the prosecutor is telling the truth on this or not. And then what? Appoint a special prosecutor for someone else to try the case? What would happen in that situation?
Okay, so there's a lot there, and I'll sort of work my way backwards. So first of all, I appreciate why the question that we keep asking is what would happen if a prosecutor didn't want to try a case or started prosecuting and wanted to stop early on, because those are situations where you would need a special prosecutor. You would need someone to do those sorts of things. We don't have that situation here. We don't have that situation at all. There's a guilty plea that's been entered by General Flynn. The only thing that's left to do here is sentencing. And federal judges are quite adept at sentencing in the absence of a recommendation from a prosecutor. That's actually something that criminal defense attorneys will bargain for in the plea bargaining process, is the prosecutors keep their mouth shut during sentencing and not say anything. So just as a practical matter, because I think that the practical argument is an appeal to sort of say it can't be this interpretation of the rule because it would lead to absurd results, is a clear one, which is it doesn't lead to any absurd results here. We have a pretty clear case where we already have a guilty plea entered, so it wouldn't lead to those absurd results. So that's one response. Are you trying to interrupt me, Clark? Because I'll let you, but I want to come back.
I want to let the audience know that there's a Q&A button in the lower right-hand portion of their screen, and we will start taking questions in, let's say, maybe 5 minutes or so. I didn't mean to interrupt. I just want to let people know to be thinking about that. Look for the Q&A button down on your lower right so we can get a good cue together. And with that, I will shut my mouth, and we can hear from Carissa some more.
No problem. And then as for the question about what do we do with judges and politics, and we need to leave things to the elected branches, I have a couple of responses. The first of which I hope is less controversial than the second. And that's that judges are asked to answer questions all the time about motives. That's not surprising at all, right? There are crimes where one of the elements is whether a defendant had a particular motive. There are sentencing guidelines where one of the questions is whether a defendant had a particular motive. So the idea that judges would be poorly equipped to look at the reasons for a decision, I think is descriptively wrong. I think that they do it quite often and it's not that big of a deal. As for the other question about whether judges need to take a step back anytime that anything might be plausibly called political, because that would somehow infringe upon the powers of the elected branches of government, I have to say I don't agree with this. And I understand that this is, you know, this is like a shibboleth of modern legal discussion, especially within the Federalist Society, that judges are supposed to play a very minimal role and they're supposed to defer to the elected branches. But I can tell you from my own research and from the research of others that as a historical matter, judges were actually quite active. They took a very active role in pushing back against the elected branches. They made policy decisions quite openly and without pretending as though that was something that they had to hide. And the idea that the other branches of government would do inappropriate things and that the judiciary was supposed to be the institution that told them they were doing something wrong is also historically quite unobjectionable. So I understand we could have a normative discussion about whether that's what we want judges to continue to do, but judges have comfortably played that role in the early decades of the Republic and well into the you know first and second centuries.
So David, respond, and then I'm going to put myself in the queue for another question.
Yeah, so I think this is a really important point, which is a lot of people keep saying that the argument on my side is for judges to have a limited role. And I want to be very clear. I want a very active and engaged judiciary to protect defendants' rights. Because the problem we have right now is judges don't do enough to protect defendants' rights. Our criminal justice system is badly broken right now because judges are sitting around and letting prosecutors run over defendants. This isn't one of those cases. This is a case where the government has agreed to dismiss. The defendant's rights aren't being implicated. So what we're asking for in this case is a judiciary to get involved where neither side wants it. It's like the two boxers who are fighting and one side throws in the white towel and the fight is over and the ref says, no, you got to get back in the ring and keep fighting, boxers, keep going. No, not where both boxers have agreed that it's over. I am not advocating for a limited judiciary. I want the judges to get more involved and protect defendants' rights. I mean, look what happened to Flynn in this case. We had Brady not handed over for over a year. We had, like Clark mentioned at the beginning, threats against his son. We had the FBI not record his statements. And then one of the assistant attorney generals complained that her statement was misconstrued, which I thought was kind of funny because under her watch, of course, she didn't have FBI record anything. So I want an active judiciary, Carissa, just to protect defendants, not to make them go through a fight where that the prosecutor doesn't want to go for.
Yeah, and I love that point of view. And I guess I'd say I don't want active judges only to protect defendants' rights because that can result in a system, right? Again, because I look at this not just as an individual case, but a question of the system. And I think that it causes problems in the system if we let the parties work it out between them. So I'll give you an example. Cuyahoga County, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, Ohio. I have a data set that's part of the book I'm writing on plea bargaining from Cuyahoga County, Ohio. And it's a data set of cases where defendants were charged with rape and sexual assault. And the data set shows what those cases were pleaded down to. And I will tell you that there were probably some good arguments in some of these cases to plead those cases down the way that they were pled down. But what it looks like from a system standpoint is that you can rape people with impunity in Cuyahoga County, Ohio, because prosecutors don't want to try those cases, and because defendants are more than happy to take incredibly lenient pleas and to cast aspersions on the victims in those cases. Now, let's be clear. I know what I'm doing here, right? I'm singling out a particularly reviled subset of defendants and a particularly sort of vulnerable group of victims. But that happened in Cuyahoga County, Ohio, and to say that the judges should have only intervened to protect the defendant's rights says that that sort of system is okay. And I don't think it is. I don't think that the judges should say, you've been accused of raping a 12-year-old girl 6 times. We're going to give you a plea to interference of custody that's probation, because there were lots and lots of those cases. Now, maybe those defendants didn't do it, in which case they shouldn't be convicted. But if they were raping 12-year-old girls, they shouldn't be getting probation.
I think we all agree on that last point. I guess what we disagree on is what should happen in those cases. What would you have happen? Would you have the judge say, I'm going to step in as prosecutor and prosecute those cases and seek a higher penalty? Because at the end of the day, right, and again, I know I keep getting back to the practical question, but at the end of the day, what will happen? The prosecutor ultimately can say, I'm not going to go forward with the case at all. So I mean, who are you going to have prosecute those cases at the trial if the prosecutor's refusing? I guess that practically we have to look at that question.
Let me, if I may, really quickly, I want to ask this in a practical, I want to bring us back to the Flynn case. This is a great question, and I'd like to hear from both of you on this. I previewed this for you, so this shouldn't come as a surprise. My question is, what if the D.C. Circuit sends the case back to the district court and Judge Sullivan attempts to proceed with the sentencing, where, you know, which is necessary in order for there to be a judgment of conviction? What if Michael Flynn refuses to show up? And what if the Marshal Service, which is not it's subject to the control of the federal judiciary, it is a Department of Justice component, the Marshal Service refuses to compel Flynn to show up personally in court. Therefore, you can't do the Rule 11 colloquy that has to happen before you can accept, well, I guess they've already accepted a guilty plea, right? So would Judge Sullivan then be sentenced in absentia? And who would go, how would Judge Sullivan obtain custody of the body, and what would happen? Would he have to take Mike Flynn home with him and lock him in his room or something? I mean, practically speaking, what is going to happen if the executive branch refuses to participate any further in this prosecution, even if Judge Sullivan is given the legal authority to go forward with it? Maybe we should let David jump in first since he's the practitioner, but I'm sure, Carissa, you have some thoughts there.
Well, I'd like to hear Carissa's answer on this, because I don't think there's anything a judge could do. I mean, if the executive decides not to enforce the penalty, decides not to go forward, the judge can do anything he, you know, can jump up and down and issue judgments and everything else. It's up to the executive to enforce those judgments. And the executive, for example, the warden can say, I'm going to order the person released compassionate release because of coronavirus. A judge can't then say, no, warden, I'm ordering you to take him back into custody and leave him there. The warden could say, no, you can't tell me what to do. I'm part of the executive branch. I'm going to release the man. So I am interested in Carissa's answer on that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is Bickel, right? The least dangerous branch, that the judiciary doesn't have the power to enforce its own judgments and it has to rely on the other branches. I mean, it could, you know, Judge Sullivan could start holding people in contempt, but it's true, he needs the executives to enforce. And I have to say, if we were having this discussion 3 years ago, I would say that norms and political pressure would ensure that the executive branch didn't do something so in such blatant disregard of the rule of law, but I no longer feel comfortable saying that. I will also say that for all the concern about the practicalities here, that the executive just doesn't want to continue with this case, that they've made their own determination, there's a constitutional mechanism for the executive branch to say, we're circumventing the courts, and that's to issue a pardon. But that's not what's happening here, right? Instead, we have a motion from DOJ, and I hope at some point we talk about, you know, why DOJ said that they wanted to dismiss this prosecution and vacate this plea agreement, because I think that those reasons are somewhat telling, and I'm happy that Judge Sullivan is interested in hearing more about those reasons, because I do think that people who are concerned about defendants' rights should be concerned about how DOJ wrote this motion. But I'm left with the thought that if you want to be able to use the legal system and say what we're doing is not political, it's legal and it's supported by doctrines and it's supported by cases and it's supported by legal powers, then we can't just sort of wave our hands and say, but what if they don't comply? Maybe they won't comply, but then that shows them as being, you know, sort of acting lawlessly.
I don't think it shows them acting lawlessly if it's up to them to enforce the judgment. If we take that is their duty. If a judge says, let me just finish this, Chris. If a judge says, I want the sentence to be 10 years, and the warden says, I'm gonna let the person go after 2 years because of overcrowding and because of other considerations. And the judge says, no, my sentence was 10 years. I think all of us would be fine with the warden saying, sorry, buddy, we're gonna release the person. It's up to that branch to enforce the judgment. So I don't think they're acting lawlessly by saying we're not going to go forward with what the judiciary says on those 10 years.
So that's only because we've created systems that permit wardens to sometimes make those sorts of decisions. And I do think that we could shift, right? If you didn't have a neutral reason, a compelling reason like coronavirus to let someone out, and a warden simply said, I'm refusing to take custody of this person because I disagree with their prosecution, I think we'd all agree that that was a lawless action. And maybe the judge can do nothing concrete about it where we would be.
A judge could hold that warden in contempt if it was lawless or something like that, but the judge couldn't appoint a special prosecutor or whatever. I know there's some questions. Clark, can
I wanted to exercise my moderator's privilege again. I'm going to be Mr. Libertarian. Part of the contractual agreement here is people show up for this event and they get to ask questions. So let me take a few questions. Let's see if we can, you know, address these pretty crisply so we have time to get through some of them. And we've actually already addressed some of the ones. But let me have you both comment on this. If we agree that politics should not play a part in the actions of the Justice Department, should judges remain docile when a federal prosecutor is clearly acting at the direction of a president or other political figure? What do you think about that?
So, you know, this goes back to the question that we've been discussing, I think, and the role of the judiciary. Even if it's a political decision that we disagree with, I think there are remedies. And I disagree with Carissa. I still have faith in the system that it's going to work. So in November, if we disagree with the decisions that this president has made, I certainly do, then we can vote him out. And I think that's going to happen. I'm concerned with judges getting involved where there isn't a case or controversy. And I know we disagree on the use of that term for a second. I want to make one other comment, and it's in response to that question and in response to something Carissa said earlier about that one county with the rape example. Of course, I don't know the specifics of that one example, and I appreciate that Carissa said she was using one extreme with rape and the violent crime or whatever. But let's be honest about what's going on in this country. We have an over-incarceration problem. We have a criminal justice system that is prosecuting and jailing too many people. So we're getting all up in arms about a dismissal in this case. There are real problems with our criminal justice system that we should be getting upset about, that we should be putting checks on prosecutors about. If there are cases where prosecutors aren't being zealous enough, I'm willing to live with that in order to try to correct the system. I'm not willing to do the opposite. Let's put more people in jail. Let's figure out a way to push more. Our system is broken enough as it is. So I think that's a big disagreement with us.
Yeah, so I'm gonna take all those points sort of backwards, and my last thing will be about the question, which I think is a good one. So first of all, I'll say I agree that there are real problems in the system, and one of those problems is unequal treatment. I think that that's a serious problem in our system, and I have to say I think that the Flynn case goes to the very heart of that problem of unequal treatment. As for whether we should simply solve the problems that we have with the criminal justice system through voting, I'm gonna raise a historical objection to that, which is to say that democracy is important, but it's not a panacea. The constitutional structure we have is not a constitutional structure that leaves everything up to democratic voting. The framers were really suspicious of democracy and put in anti-democratic checks like an unelected judiciary, specifically because they didn't think periodic votes were enough.
We agree.
The last thing that I'll say, because I think that that's a really important question, what do we do about federal prosecutors taking direct advice from the president or from Maine Justice. And I'm glad that the person asked this question, because I think that we want to untangle, I'm going to sound like an academic again here, I want to untangle what we talk about, or what we mean when we talk about politics. I don't think there's any getting away from the idea that U.S. attorneys are political actors, right? They're appointed and confirmed. A lot of them get their jobs because they know politically connected people in their districts. So it's political that way. And I certainly don't think that any of us would dispute that the president and the attorney general should make policy for the Department of Justice. I think that that's also political, right? They're setting policy. But one place where people have always been, or at least in recent decades, have been concerned about political interference in the justice system is on the level of the individual case, right? This was the complaint when the George W. Bush administration fired those U.S. attorneys. It's because some of those firings were seen to be interference in specific cases. And that's the sort of political interference that has traditionally been held up as the line that you shouldn't cross. And again, I'll say, this case is, I think, a pretty obvious candidate for the category of interference in a specific case. And it's not the only one too, right? I mean, I was happy to see the Department of Justice in Roger Stone's case say that the guideline sentence was too harsh. I wish they took that as a policy and didn't simply file a brief like that in a case involving an advisor of the president.
Well, I want to get to another question that probably, I'd say, about a quarter or a third of the questions have touched on this, and that's the issue of possible Brady violations in this case. If you read the government's motion to dismiss, they're a little bit coy about this, but there's been a lot of coverage and a lot of suggestion that there may have been some misconduct on the part of the special counsel's office prosecutors. And one particular piece of evidence that has gotten a lot of attention is what's sometimes referred to as the original 302. So this is the form that FBI agents prepare from their written notes that they take during an interview, because as I think most of us probably know, they don't electronically record interviews still in this day. And what they do is they take their notes and they write up a form 302 to memorialize the interview. And what appears to have happened in this case is that Flynn's defense team kept asking the special counsel's office for a copy of that 302 throughout the month of November and kept getting rebuffed. And what was ultimately produced to them appears to have been a fairly extensively edited form 302 that, based on certain document disclosures that have been made since then, it looks like people who weren't even present during the interview, like Peter Strzok and Lisa Page, may have edited. I'm sorry, Peter Strzok was there, but perhaps others who weren't there may have edited. What, if any, significance should the sort of increasing drumbeat of possible impropriety on the part of federal prosecutors, particularly in the withholding of Brady material? And let's keep in mind, Judge Sullivan is one of the very few judges in the entire country who has what's called a standing Brady order, which is a court order that obliges prosecutors to produce Brady evidence, including during plea negotiations, and makes the failure to produce that evidence a contempt of court. Should that have any bearing at all on anything that's currently in front of the D.C. Circuit? What do you think?
I mean, if you're asking my opinion, I'll say I think I probably agree with you in part, Clark, and disagree with you in part, because you've highlighted things like, the question of Brady evidence, the question of whether the FBI threatened to charge Michael Flynn's son, the fact that he wasn't advised before this interview that, that he could be charged. These things have all, you and David have referred to these as defense rights. And I actually just think it's important to point out they're not, unfortunately, right? Yes, Judge Sullivan has a standing order telling prosecutors that they have to hand over materials, but he's the only one. And the Supreme Court has not said that Brady applies to plea bargaining, and the lower courts are split on that. Courts have repeatedly said that wired pleas are permitted. There is no obligation on the part of federal prosecutors or any prosecutors to record these sorts of interviews. So I don't feel comfortable calling these issues defense rights issues, because they've pretty clearly they're pretty clearly not considered to be rights. And you said that the Justice Department was coy in their motion. I don't think I agree with that word choice. I actually think that they were very careful in how they wrote their motion to not say that this was prosecutorial misconduct, to not say that defendants are entitled to this sort of material, and to not leave open the possibility of future defendants or even current defendants or past defendants who have nearly identical things done to them by federal law enforcement that they would be able to get any relief whatsoever.
So I'd like to just talk about that for a second. I mean, I think Carissa's both right and wrong. So she's right in that this happens every day of the week to defendants all around the country. And that's a real tragedy. That's why NACDL has come out and said we have a trial problem in our country, and 97 to 98% of defendants plead guilty, including innocent defendants. And so to me, it's a good thing that this is being highlighted. It's good that Roger Stone, the DOJ in Roger Stone's case, said the sentencing guidelines are too harsh. The question is, do we want to say, well, even if they're too harsh, he should be sentenced under those guidelines because everybody else is? Everybody else is getting screwed, so he should be screwed too? Or should we say, no, everybody should get the benefit of the guidelines being too harsh? And to me, the only way we're going to make change is to say, look, what DOJ is saying here is correct. Instead of being outraged that Michael Flynn or Roger Stone are getting these deals, we should embrace them. We should be happy about it. We should highlight this and show this is how other defendants should get the benefit of this too. Not nobody should get the benefit of it.
So I agree with you that we should highlight it. I don't think enough people in this country understand what the dynamic is in plea bargaining, and I think that's part of the reason why it happens. But I don't agree that embracing this is going to lead to change, and this is where I'm going to be somewhat cynical. I think many of us put up with injustice in the criminal justice system right now. Those of us who, you know, who are relatively empowered, who feel like we know super smart lawyers like David in case we get in trouble, we think to ourselves, if something bad happens, I will be okay. But it's okay that the FBI is using these sorts of tactics against other people because those are bad people, right? Those are the people that we really want to lock up. And we don't like proof beyond a reasonable doubt. We think that that's too high of a standard. If DOJ had changed its sentencing policy in the wake of the Roger Stone sentencing, I would take a very different approach to this. But they didn't. And so that, to me, is an example of injustice. And all of the signs in this case suggest that it would be another. If DOJ can't say people should be permitted to withdraw their guilty plea if they feel like it later, or we should always hand over these 302s before plea bargaining, or even that this was misconduct, I would feel differently. But you read this motion, David, I don't know how you can read these motions and not think that DOJ is doing everything that they can to insulate themselves from having to take any claims that are similar seriously in any case.
But I guess my question to you is, so just to use the Roger Stone case as an example, would you say then that we should have given him the unjust, harsh sentence under the guidelines? Or are you happy that he didn't get that harsh sentence, even though other people aren't, so that we can use that and argue in front of judges, look, here's what DOJ said there. We should follow that rule, judges. We should follow that rule and not have unjust, harsh sentences under the guidelines.
So DOJ did not say that the sentencing guidelines are too harsh. And they routinely say the opposite. They instead said in this particular case, they're too harsh. They didn't even push back on the really big enhancement. They're like, no, it's true. The enhancement applies. But it would be harsh in this particular case. That's all that they did. I have no problem with the judge giving a below guideline sentence in that case, because in the post-Booker world, we don't need the government to acquiesce to a below guideline sentence. That's just,
of course,
the powers have shifted, right? But a judge can't, and maybe you know, in very few circumstances can a federal judge say, I'm going to dismiss this indictment right now. They can't do it because the prosecutor didn't hand over Brady material before somebody entered a plea. They can't do it under prevailing case law because the plea was wired to another family member. They can't do it in a 1001 case because the original interview wasn't recorded. These are all things where judges would be told that they had to defer to the discretion of the prosecutor to make these sorts of decisions. We don't have that situation in sentencing. Thank goodness.
Well, I'm going to ask a question that was directed towards one of the participants, and I'm going to depersonalize it by maybe having all of us weigh in. And the question is, if someone threatened your child with prosecution and essentially said, if you agree to plead guilty, I will not go after your child, and if you don't agree to plead guilty, I will go after your child, would that be enough to get you to plead guilty to a crime that you did not commit? And I'll go first, and I'll say, absolutely yes. There isn't the slightest question in my mind that under those circumstances, I would plead guilty to pretty much anything the government put in front of me. I would sign my name. I would stand up in front of a judge, and I would lie through my teeth and say that I did what they said I did in order to protect my children. Why, given that there are credible allegations that that happened in this case, and I'm aware that there is preposterous and despicable DC Circuit precedent that says that that is non-coercive, and I use both of those words advisedly. That's the Pollard case, and it is a disgrace. But why should we have any faith in the integrity of any given guilty plea in our system when we know that prosecutors are not only permitted to use those kinds of medieval draconian techniques, but that anybody who practices criminal defense knows they do routinely? Why on earth should anybody have any faith in the integrity of any guilty plea that's entered in our system when we permit prosecutors to do that?
So I would 100%, without pausing for a moment, plead guilty if prosecutors were threatening to prosecute my children. If I were innocent, if my children were innocent, I would 100% do that. And Clark, you're right that courts would not consider that to be a coercive plea. Now, I think the question was asked here, and maybe we shouldn't get into this, but I think I will anyways. Why should we not think that General Flynn is innocent here? And I'll say, he might be, but there are reasons that I have to doubt that. I have reasons to doubt that he's factually innocent. His claim to factual innocence is twofold. It's a legal claim about materiality, which I'd be more than happy to talk about, including the fact that DOJ cited the wrong standard for materiality in their Rule 48 motion. And number two, it's a mens rea claim, right? It's a claim that he didn't have the mental state, that he did not know that he was lying to the FBI. And I will say that as a factual matter, I have reasons to doubt that Michael Flynn did not know that he was lying to the FBI. And I'd be happy to talk about that if people are interested in talking about the facts of this case. But if you're asking whether innocent people plead guilty, they definitely do. If you're asking whether this tactic is likely to make it happen, most assuredly, yes.
Let me just respond. I don't know whether Michael Flynn is guilty or not, and I really don't care. I will say that there's no way to know from a guilty plea in our system. Our system, because people plead guilty, that does not aid in finding the truth whatsoever. Our founders wanted trials. And that's the Rule 11 actually is there to try to discourage pleas if we want to get into the history of Rule 11. Unfortunately, the sentencing guidelines came around in 1984 and changed the whole system around and forced people to plead guilty. And one of the reasons, whether he's innocent or not, Michael Flynn felt the pressure to plead guilty because he was looking at time, because his kid may have been threatened. Who knows why? We won't know whether he's innocent or guilty unless we had a trial in this case. He had moved to vacate his plea. We should all be in favor of judges vacating pleas when defendants want to vacate pleas. We should be in favor of more trials and in favor of less coercive pleas. The problem here is that all those factors that were present with Flynn are present, like Carissa says, in other defendants' cases. So, and I guess we come at it from different ways. I'm happy that they're being highlighted here because I think it exposes our criminal justice system. So it makes me happy that Flynn's case is being used as an example to most people who don't have exposure to the criminal justice system. I'm friends on the other side of the aisle who are typically pro law enforcement and law and order are seeing, wow, this can happen to us as well. And so I'm happy that these terrible tactics in our criminal justice system are being exposed.
And I guess I would just say, I'm actually not so sure that this is a good case for people to learn about the criminal justice system, because the truth is the only reason that Michael Flynn feels comfortable moving to set aside his plea at this point is because the Russia investigation is over, and he and his lawyers can be quite confident that the current Justice Department is not going to refile all of the charges that they bargained away as part of the plea bargain. So one of my concerns is that the general public is going to look at this case and say, well, innocent people will be able to simply file a motion after the fact to set aside their plea. That's actually not true, because this is the rare case where the leverage for the plea goes away, right? The Justice Department isn't going to indict Michael Flynn Jr. They're not going to come back about the Foreign Agent Registration Act claims. They're not going to refile any of these charges, and that's ordinarily what they would do, and that's why innocent people don't move to vacate their pleas.
Okay, we got to wrap up, so can maybe each take 30 seconds and bring it home?
Sure. Krista, you want to go first, or you want me to go first?
I'm happy to go first.
Go ahead.
Unless you want to. Do you want to go first?
No, go ahead.
First of all, I'm really glad
the defense attorney. We should give the defense attorney the unusual experience of getting to go last.
Now we're talking.
That's right. And I always get the last word in my classroom. So let me just say, first of all, I'm really glad that the Federalist Society decided to have this debate. I have a lot of respect for Clark. I have a lot of respect for David. I think that this is a difficult case, but I think it's a difficult case not for the reasons that most people think it is. I don't think it's a difficult case because of the politics. I think it's a difficult case because of the criminal justice system that we have. And I really hope that David is right, and that this case will cause people to rethink the criminal justice system that we've built in this country. But unfortunately, I don't think that it will. And I do think that if we let one person escape from the terrible system that we've built because that person is politically connected, we actually make a system worse than if we have an unjust system to which everybody is subject.
So I too would like to thank everybody for doing this. It's been really great, and I love having the opportunity to talk about these issues, especially with someone as great and smart as Carissa and Clark and Jefferson. Thanks for putting this together. To me, I couldn't agree more with something Carissa said, that the law should apply equally to everybody. In the ordinary case, the judge would have dismissed this matter on a Rule 48 motion and never would have looked behind what the prosecutor was saying. Unfortunately, because this is such a high-profile case, the judge has decided to do so, and I think that's a big mistake, because now the judge has put himself at the center of the controversy, and the judge has now politicized the judiciary, which to me is very sad. The reason we don't want judges getting involved, I think, is for what Justice Roberts said. We want judges calling balls and strikes, not pitching or batting, and we certainly don't want people going to the ballgame to see the judge. To me, this is a simple question where the prosecutor and defendant agree on the result. And in that case, we should treat Flynn just like everybody else and dismiss it. So again, thanks everybody for putting this together. I've had a ball, and I hope people got something out of it.